this is Jeff Blankfort with the August 28th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday I want to open the phones to get your takes on the world. You have no doubt heard more than enough about the latest antics of the president in Biarritz last weekend, where the cloud of Trump's escalating tariff war with China hung over the meeting of the Group 7, or G7 countries. Trump, to no one's surprise, and certainly not his own, was the center of attention, as well as the press's derision at the gathering of his once Washington's close allies. He seemed to leave little space for his doppelganger, Britain's new Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who was making his debut at the G7 shortly after being elected by his Conservative Parliament members. His decision to pull the UK out of the European Union by October 31st, known as Brexit, with or without a deal with Brussels, might have attracted more attention had Trump not been there, because it too promises to have an effect on the shaky global financial structure. At the end of the G7 summit, Johnson did give a press conference, The Guardian reported, in which, when asked repeatedly what he would do if MPs, members of Parliament, did not go along with him, the British Prime Minister declined to rule out shutting down Parliament. "I think that this really is a matter for parliamentarians to get right ourselves," he said. "We asked the people to vote on whether they wanted to stay in or leave the EU. They voted to leave by a big majority," end quote. Boris Johnson, he said, "I think people had just about had enough of this conversation." Johnson went on, "I think they're yearning for the moment when Brexit comes off the front pages of the national papers, and that will only happen when we come out of the EU on October 31st, and that is what I'm calling on all my fellow members of Parliament to do," end quote. Well, as you heard this morning on NPR, Boris Johnson has, in effect, told his MPs to go home, having taken the unusual and highly controversial step of suspending Parliament, and he has done it with a Queen's approval. What it all means and what comes next for the UK, I'll be examining at 20 minutes past the hour with Kenneth Surin, the British-educated professor emeritus of literature and critical theory at Duke University, so stay tuned for that. What was clear at the G7 summit was the desire on the part of the Europeans to maintain economic relations with Iran, despite the obvious efforts of John Bolton, Trump's national security advisor, and his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to overthrow the Tehran government. In pursuit of that goal, French President Emmanuel Macron invited Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif to Biarritz, the French seaside resort town, on Sunday as leaders met nearby. Whether Trump has been informed about Zarif's visit in advance wasn't clear, but added a curious touch to the event was that on July 31st, Washington added Zarif to the list of Iranians targeted by U.S. sanctions. According to Bloomberg News, Macron also touted an agreement to send a joint message from the G7 to Iran as one of his victories from a dinner among the leaders. "We've enacted a common communication, which in my eyes has a lot of value," he said in a French television interview. And when the subject was broached, Trump said he would be pleased to sit down with the Iranian President Rouhani, but Rouhani's reply was what it had been to such a just suggestion in the past, that the U.S. must first drop its sanctions against Iran. In the meantime, without any comment from the president, his best buddy, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, has been engaged in very dangerous muscle flexing in recent days. Apparently stung by the accusations that his refusal to let Congress members Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib enter Israel 2 weeks ago was at Trump's behest and was a sign of weakness, and worried about a snap election he had called for next month, Netanyahu had the U.S. armed Israeli Defense Forces launch attacks at three Arab countries and threaten a fourth. Beginning Saturday evening and lasting into late Sunday afternoon, Israel carried out strikes against Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. By dawn Monday, it had also attacked members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, as well as Palestinians from the PFLP-GC, the acronym for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, an offshoot of the older PFLP, which had been in decline over the past few decades. It was only 5 days ago that AP reported that U.S. officials confirmed that Israel was responsible for the bombing of an alleged Iranian weapons depot in Iraq in July. That attack and those since mark a significant escalation in Israel's campaign against what it sees as Iranian military assets in the region. The confirmation came as Netanyahu strongly hinted that his country was behind recent air raids that have hit bases and munition depots belonging to Iran-backed paramilitary forces operating in Iraq. Last week, the deputy head of the Iraq Shia militias, known collectively as the Popular Mobilization Forces, which had participated in the campaign against ISIS, accused Israel of sending drones to carry out the attacks, but ultimately blamed Washington and threatened retaliation in the case of any future attack. That retaliation could come against U.S. forces that remain stationed in Iraq, a matter that seems as little concern to the Trump White House as it is to Israel. The attacks are also potentially destabilizing for Iraq's government, which includes a number of pro-Iranian legislators. Israel also claimed to have carried out more than 1,000 airstrikes against alleged Iranian targets in Syria, coordinated apparently with the Russian Air Force under orders by President Putin, who is also very close to Netanyahu. Israel's number one enemy, however, to judge from the Israeli political class and press, is Hezbollah, which Israel and the U.S. insist is a terrorist organization, ignoring the fact that it was born as a Lebanese resistance group opposed to Israel's occupation of that country following its invasion in 1982, and which succeeded after 18 years in driving Israel's occupation forces, who had terrorized the country, back across the border in 2000. Hezbollah, while supported by Iran, has become a major factor in Lebanon's political life, having an alliance with the leading Maronite Christian Party, the Free Patriotic Movement, dominated the country's national elections for more than a decade, a fact that the U.S. media does its best to hide. In 2006, it fought a three-week war with Israel, and its fighters were so successful in stopping Israel's vaunted military forces on the ground that it forced the resignation of the IDF's chief of staff, General Dan Halutz, shortly after the fighting ended. Since then, Israeli officials seem to be aching for another go-around with Hezbollah, which is reflected in its national media. Here's how the Jerusalem Post's Seth Frantzman describes it after, mind you, the Israelis sent two drones into the predominantly Shia quarter in Beirut, one of which contained explosives that shattered a building where Hezbollah meets with foreign journalists. Quote, Hezbollah and its allies are building a case for war, and Lebanon's media and other officials are fueling the tensions with assertions that drones that crashed in Beirut carried bombs, Frantzman wrote. Whether or not, he says, whether or not the drones carried C4 explosives or not, their aim was to carry out a bombing or target individuals, not particularly important, because what matters is the calculations going on beneath the surface in Lebanon, end quote. Get that? Would any Israeli journalist dare say that was not, quote, particularly important if a bomb had exploded at the Israeli press office in Tel Aviv, or at an individual Israeli who had been targeted? I doubt it, but here's the Jerusalem Post, Seth, quote, Lebanon's President Michel Aoun, he writes, by inferring that the incident marks a kind of declaration of war, ups the rhetoric and the chances that a green light has been given to Hezbollah to retaliate. The main issue Hezbollah has faced in the past since Israel withdrawn in 2000, he says, is to try to create a legitimate reason for maintaining a massive armed force within a functioning state. He has been able to keep its arsenal, not only because no one can disarm it, but also through claiming it is part of, quote, a resistance that defends Lebanon. This was all a veneer for the real reason of Hezbollah's existence, which the Jerusalem Post, Seth Frantzman continues, which is stockpiling, which is that as an Iranian proxy, an ally, which wants the group to continue stockpiling its weapons and building up its infrastructure along Israel's border to threaten Israel, end quote. That's a line taken by Israel and its powerful advocacy groups in Washington, but it contains no more truth than the accusations that the North Vietnamese or the Sandinistas were fronts for Moscow in the last millennium. I've been to Lebanon a number of times, including 1983 and 2007, a year after Israel's last two wars on Lebanon, in which Israel killed 20,000 and 1,000 civilians respectively. I saw and photographed whole blocks of apartment houses in Beirut on each occasion that were leveled or split apart by Israeli missiles, or more precisely, U.S. manufactured missiles that Washington had provided to his Israeli friends at no charge. And I saw the sadism with which the Israeli occupiers treated the Lebanese civilian population, which doesn't require instructions from Iran to tell them who is their enemy. In 2007, I spent 45 minutes conversing with Lebanese President, former General Michel Aoun. He told me frankly that were it not for Hezbollah, the Israelis would overrun his country as they had in 1982, when there was no army or Hezbollah to stop them. And I would insist there was no arguing with that. Long before the Israeli state was established, the early Zionists had their eyes on southern Lebanon, and particularly the rich waters of the Litani River. During the post-World War I discussions at the League of Nations, the leader of the World Zionist Movement and the man who would become Israel's first president, Chaim Weizmann, demanded that southern Lebanon, up to and including the Litani, be part of the British Mandate and subsequently the Jewish national home. The French, who were to take what was then Syria and break it into two states, a Maronite-dominated Lebanon and what is now Syria, said no, and for the Lebanese today, whatever their religion, the answer is still no. Now in the Israeli press, one can routinely read warnings from political officials and generals, active duty and retired, and that promise that should another war with Hezbollah, quote, break out, that's the term they use as if it's describing a rash, because the Lebanese government supports Hezbollah, the Israeli Air Force, using U.S.-supplied bombs and missiles, will consider all of Lebanon a legitimate target and bomb it back to the Stone Age. The Stone Age. And if that wasn't enough, the Israeli paper Ma'ariv last week, citing a Kuwaiti paper, suggested that Israel will extend its war on Iran to Yemen, taking the side of Saudi Arabia against the besieged Houthis. Quote, Israel's fight against the shipment of weapons from Iran to organizations under its protection may reach new districts, wrote the paper. Sources from the Kuwaiti paper Al Jarida claim that Israel plans to attack targets of Houthi rebels and Hezbollah in Yemen near the Straits of Bab el-Mandeb, separating the Red Sea from the Gulf of Aden. According to the source, the Mossad and military intelligence are monitoring Iran's attempts to deliver weapons, including missiles and drones, which could be used for terrorist attacks against the region's maritime network, end quote. I should mention that it is quite common for Israeli newspapers to cite articles in the foreign press, in this instance Kuwait, when reporting on information that was restricted by Israel's military censors. Israel is clearly looking for a war that will encompass the entire Middle East and quite likely well beyond it. In its own economic war with Iran, the U.S. suffered a humiliating setback 10 days ago when its efforts to take possession of Iranian oil tanker were foiled, supposedly bound for Syria, that had been seized and held by British Marines off Gibraltar. And not giving up on taking what isn't ours, a State Department official announced the U.S. will aggressively enforce its sanctions to prevent the private sector from assisting an Iranian oil tanker that is traveling through the Mediterranean and that Washington once seized. That shipping sector is on notice. We'll aggressively enforce U.S. sanctions, the official told Reuters, after warning countries not to allow the tanker to dock. And now we've learned that tanker has been sold to an undisclosed buyer. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.